This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, we should say host, but also realtors with Oakland Realty in downtown Vancouver. Super excited to have Brendan Lacerda back on the show. Brendan, of course, is the director of economic research for North America for Moody's Analytics. Past guest fan favorite. He is a guy that really understands what's going on in Canada. And of course, he's talking to us from Philadelphia from an outsider's perspective as a U.S. citizen.
That's what I really like about Brendan. I feel like there's not often you get a chance to talk to a guy. It's like talking to somebody who studies like the Middle East or something, but we're the Middle East in this case. Outsider looking in, rolling over all the data that he has at his disposal and calling the shots. What does he think about Vancouver real estate? What's the upside potential versus downside potential? You'll have to wait to find out. But I would say this is more a broad conversation about the Canadian economy, the outlook, interest rates, and where Brendan sees Canada heading from here. So it's a really exciting and interesting conversation with a really smart guy.
Yeah, and I think the outsider perspective is super useful because, I mean, I feel like we're so in the data, deep diving into the market here all the time. And I feel like everyone in Vancouver that's watching the market, like it's very hard to see outside of what you're operating in, right?
Get outside.
Kind of reminds me of when I had a personal trainer look at my diet. Turns out I wasn't eating correctly. I'd convinced myself. Okay, so here's the thing. He was like, "My lord,
he's a personal trainer for Canada."
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're doing fine. Exactly.
Yeah, only vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. But before we get to this conversation, Matt, of course, we've got the segment that remains nameless.
Absolutely. Yeah, this question, trivia question this week is quite an easy one, Adam. If you've been following the local news, this could be a challenge. We'll see. Adam, the building formerly known as Nordstrom's downtown has been picked up by a new company, a Canadian company. I'll give you a hint. It's going to be what I would think would be their Western Canadian flagship store. Very exciting news for people that are excited about downtown and very excited for people who like buying really interesting clothes that is kind of slightly offbeat, I would say.
Slightly offbeat.
Well, you know what? I've bought a couple shirts from there and they always, every time I put them on, I'm wearing one right now and I go, feels slightly European. And maybe that's too much information. Yeah. There's a little bit of flair to it, a little bit of flair that I'm not even sure I can pull off. But before we get to that, Adam, let's talk. I think you know which company.
Tell me you're a boring middle-aged man without telling me. Hang on.
Before we get to that, Adam, I don't want to hear your guess. I want to talk about one of our listings because we got a couple new exciting listings, but the one I want to highlight this week is 915 East 23rd Ave, Adam. This is a single family home. Talk about location. It's about three blocks east of Fraser on 23rd. So walking to that area of Fraser, it's just an unbelievable spot. But nestled on a residential street, a block from Glen Park, which if you've ever hung out in Glen Park in the summer, you know what I'm talking about. This is an incredible spot. Oversized lot, 2001 house. The thing I like about it is there's so much flexibility here. The upper floor is a three bedroom, so you can have and there's three kitchens. So the second floor and basement can be income suites. One can be a mother-in-law suite, or you can take over the entire house. So many options. Nine beds, Adam, six baths, over 3,300 square feet. Did I mention it's an oversized lot? Offered at $2,199,900. You can go check this house out at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. It's a beautiful one. The location is phenomenal. And click sell with us while you're there to download our sold plan to get your property ready for market and get top dollar. But Adam, let's get back to the most important thing at hand.
The trivia.
The trivia, which company is taking the old Pacific Center Nordstrom spot?
I love that you're wearing a brown golf shirt and you act like you're like Liberace or something. This is like the most, you got a lot of flair going on there, Elton John. Hang on. It's Simons, Matt. I'm not living under a rock here. That's the easiest trivia question you've sent my way. And we're trying to
get the percentage back up.
You know what's funny is I've never looked or thought much about this, but it's funny that like the Bay can't make sense of the department store, but like a Simons seems to be doing it similarly, but different, right? I mean, you can go to Simons, you can get like pillows and throws and beddings, but you can also get shoes, sunglasses, clothes, dinnerware. It's like it's a department store essentially, right?
Yeah. But yeah.
Anyways,
and they're not sure how the numbers work. They're not paying for this. What I will say, Adam, is my understanding is double digit growth at Simons in Western Canada over the last 3 years. And I think it's that little bit of flair. I think it's a little bit of flair that's attracting everyone. At least that was at their West Vancouver shop, as I understand it. But let's cut to our talk with Director of Economic Research in North America with that Canadian specialty, Brandon Lacerda.
Can't wait for this one.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown, and we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much, and we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Brandon Lacerda. He is the director in the Economic Research Group at Moody's Analytics. Welcome back, Brandon, past guest fan favorite. So happy to have you here.
Adam and Matt, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Right on. Well, maybe for the people who, you know, it's been about a year, I think we figure, since you were last on, Brandon. Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, professional economist, I've been with Moody's for, and I'm just about to hit the 10-year mark here. And what we do is macroeconomic forecasting. And so that is predicting the future for all those key macroeconomic variables that banks, insurers, industries, GDP, unemployment, CPI, house prices, interest rates. There's a long list of all of them. The idea is we're going to forecast that, and businesses can utilize that information for planning, risk analysis, things of that sort. Primarily what we do is alternative macroeconomic scenario forecasting. Because there's a lot of baseline forecasts out there. You know, every bank has a baseline forecast. But really where we specialize is in the what-if scenarios, the hypothetical of what could happen, and understanding sort of that distribution of risk and, you know, what are the implications of those different risks for your business. Or maybe this is the survivability of your business in a potentially, you know, downside economic scenario.
Okay, well, one of the reasons we brought you on is because obviously we've been looking at the Canadian economy here. Quite a bit has changed since we spoke to you last. And obviously, we're in BC, so our economy, I feel like we're in a bit of an echo chamber, and it's hard to kind of see what's going on in our economy as an outsider. You watch from Philadelphia. What are Canadians missing about their own economy?
Well, you get to see it up close. I see the economy mostly through the data. So maybe that makes me a little less biased since, you know, I just have to rely mostly on the numbers. What I see, I was trying to think earlier today, how would I sum up Canada's recent economic performance in like one word or something like that? It kind of feels like limbo or like stasis or stalled. There's no economy. So I would say this, the last time we spoke, tariffs were getting underway. We were pretty concerned about a recession in Canada, given the threats that were being made. As it turns out, President Trump didn't fully follow through on those threats. So, sort of the economic fallout ended up being, less than we had initially feared, but it was still substantial. And what you see in the Canadian data is basically the speed of the economy, the speed of growth in Canada just slows to zero. So, it's not in a recession. We don't see any of the sort of key measures, flashing big warning lights, trouble. But the economy is not really growing. And that reflects a lot of uncertainties on businesses about where is tariff policy headed? What's going to happen to the USMCA? When is, how is this, military conflict in the Middle East going to play out? So there's just so much uncertainty hanging over businesses that they don't want to embark on big new investments. They don't want to go on a big hiring spree. And they're playing it conservative. That also means that they're not laying people off wholesale. They're not panicked that the sky is falling and we need to, plant down, conserve cash, going to, do defense mode, a Citadel mode or something like that. So that's why I said sort of the stasis, this limbo. You sort of feel the economy just sort of hanging and like waiting for something to happen, sort of telling businesses like, which way should I go on, my payroll or my capital expenditures.
So Brandon, you listed a bunch of uncertainties there, a lot of them external to Canada, at the very least. I feel like a lot of those we don't have a lot of control over. And this might be outside of your wheelhouse, but how do we get out of this? Like if uncertainty's the kind of shroud that hangs over new investment, hiring, kind of getting the economy back going, like what's the game plan? And again, this might be outside of what you're doing on a day-to-day.
No, I'm sure these are like the same conversations that, the prime minister is asking his, cabinet. It's, how do we get out of this situation? How can we give businesses more confidence? And I don't think I have a great answer for that because so many, all these issues are just beyond Canada's control. I mean, I don't think Canada has much, influence over U.S. foreign policy, so it's not clear how it would at all be able to affect what's going on in Iran. I think the one big opportunity to resolve the uncertainty is on the tariff front and with trade. So we have the official start of the USMCA renewal negotiations kicking off in July. They're already having sort of behind the scenes talks right now. So there's sort of been surprisingly few details have really emerged from those discussions about what a final agreement might actually look like. But presumably, as we anticipate in our Canadian baseline forecast, we get some deal. The tariffs are not all going away. Some of the tariffs are going to remain. The U.S. administration's been, pretty clear about that. But as long as they're reduced, and as long as, policy isn't constantly changing, then businesses can get back to planning. And I think they, do start to, hiring picks back up, investment starts to pick back up. So our baseline forecast is that the Canadian economy just muddles through the first half of the year. And then we start to see some green shoots emerge in the later half of 2026. A big part of that forecast is also assuming that the U.S.-Iran conflict starts to, quiet down. Maybe not like an official ceasefire, but at least trade through the Strait of Hormuz mostly normalizes, and that, you know, there isn't significant long-term damage to global supply chains or global energy markets. So maybe you want to call that optimistic, that, you know, sort of both of these key risks, we're saying, you know, end of 2026, you know, we think they're headed in a better direction. But if you're on board with that, then, you know, what our models and, you know, what our analysis is expecting is that growth will start to reaccelerate. And that economy will start to regain momentum towards the end of 2026.
And what drives that momentum in your mind?
So part of it is some of the tariffs do come off, likely expecting, particularly around like the auto industry and the metals, that they bring those tariff rates down. And that helps to, you know, start to kickstart exports again. The other key factor is Canada, open economy, highly dependent on foreign trade. It's been, you know, attempting this pivot away from the United States, trying to, you know, find new export markets. And we see some success. You know, we can see that exports to, you know, the non-US globe is increasing. It just hasn't been enough yet. And part of the problem there is, you know, you may argue, oh, you know, these high oil prices are good for Canada, or, you know, at the very least, you know, it offsets, you know, good for some parts, you know, bad for other parts of Canada. But for the globe at large, you know, this oil price shock is bad news, and puts a serious, you know, dent in demand. So, you know, I think oil is about 30% of Canadian exports. The other 70% of Canadian exports are under a lot of pressure right now because global demand is weak. So if energy prices come down, global growth starts to pick back up again, you'd expect demand for those other Canadian exports to also pick back up.
Brennan, you've been watching Canada for quite some time and studying the economy here. Can you talk about maybe how Canada's economy has changed over the past few years? And the other question kind of tied to that is it mostly an uncertainty story, or is there more to the picture about the Canadian economy? Because, you know, we often talk about policy changes and political leadership and all that sort of thing. So is there more to the story there?
I think there is, because I've been getting a lot of questions recently about, are high oil prices a net positive or a net negative for Canada? That seems to be kind of like one of the key questions at the moment. And, you know, I think there's this general conception, well, you know, Canada's this big oil exporter, you know, this has to be good for Canada. I think that assessment is probably more accurate or representative of what the Canadian economy looked like 20 years ago, maybe like 30 years ago, much more focused on goods production, much more focused on commodity exports. But if we think about where so much of the economic growth has taken place in Canada in the last 20 years, it's the boom towns like Toronto, Vancouver, you know, a couple other places too. And, you know, that economy is not oriented around natural resource extraction. It's a modern service economy, tech, software, increasingly now, you know, AI and other cloud computing. That's more, the Canadian economy has been shifting in that direction. So I've been trying to push the argument that on net, these high oil prices are probably bad for Canada, a net negative. Whereas 30 years ago, it probably would have been a net positive.
You know, just thinking about that, can we talk a little bit about how the different regions of Canada are doing? And I don't know how granular your kind of modeling gets, but just thinking about, you know, you mentioned the auto sector, which is primarily in Ontario. You mentioned high oil prices, which presumably benefits Alberta more than at least the gas prices in Vancouver. So can we talk a little bit about how different regions are doing right now, the strongest areas, the weaker areas? And when you talk about green shoots at the end of 2026, is that across the board, or are we going to see certain areas really emerge over others?
Yeah, and this is probably a good opportunity to insert my shameless plug, which is we produce forecasts and our alternative scenario forecasts for all 10 provinces and 32, 33 metro areas in Canada. So one of those insights we try to offer is to, you know, take that global macro picture and bring it down to the metro level and, you know, say, what does it mean specifically for different metro economies? No surprise on sort of the industrial diversity across Canada. Obviously, the big energy producing regions are going to be, you know, the beneficiaries here. So that means Alberta, also some North Atlantic oil off of, you know, like Newfoundland, Brunswick, and things up there. So there's some offshore oil up there, but by and large, the big benefit here is to Alberta. There's one caveat on that, I think, which is, and I wrote an article about this last week, which is that Canada seems to have a bit of a pipeline capacity problem. Think about the politics of going back, you know, in the Trudeau administration when, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline was killed. You know, there's been a lot of opposition to running a east-west pipeline through British Columbia. So apart from a few exceptions, there hasn't been significant investment in new pipeline capacity in Canada in, you know, a few decades. So Canadian pipelines are running at, you know, 90% like plus capacity. So the problem becomes, you know, now prices shoot up. And as an oil producer, you know, your goal is to just try to get as many barrels to market as you can. That's hard for Canadian producers right now. Rail capacity is also pretty tight. I said pipeline capacity is tight. So what it means is that, you know, in terms of, you think sort of the economic implications here is that this spike in oil prices is likely just to generate sort of a windfall temporary profit for Alberta. The question of sort of, you know, could this lead to new investment, new jobs? You know, they really change the long run trajectory on Alberta's oil industry. I'm not so sure. You know, are businesses, are oil producers going to invest in new wells and new pipelines, you know, just because the oil price is jacked up right now? They would get burned if, you know, suddenly a ceasefire, you know, oil prices crash down, and then, you know, those investments don't make sense anymore. Because one of the problems is that Alberta has the cost of extracting a barrel in Alberta is much higher than many other key sources of oil elsewhere in the world. So typically, new investment in Alberta only makes sense when oil prices are really, really high. And they need to be high for a sustained period of time. Now, depending on how this U.S.-Iran conflict evolves, I mean, if this really goes on for a while, I think you could start to see a lot of countries look to Canada as a more reliable source of oil. In which case, you know, you would get a much bigger economic benefit coming into Alberta, new jobs, new investment, all that stuff. I don't think that's likely to happen. So in terms of, you know, what this means for the different regions of Canada, for Alberta, it's a big temporary windfall. For the rest of Canadians, you know, they're just feeling the pain at the pump, you know, paying extra for gasoline.
In your mind, Brendan, is there any low-hanging fruit that Canada can kind of capitalize on to get the economy in a better spot? And is it, you suggested earlier that creating new trade relationships seems to be something that might be a green shoot in the future. Is that the way forward in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that it's not my proposal. You know, it's one that's been discussed widely. Is the amount of, like, you know, increasing interprovincial trade. I'm a professional economist, and even I wasn't sort of fully aware of, you know, all the different regulatory frameworks across provinces and, you know, how difficult it makes that for businesses to, you know, operate across the entire country. You just don't see regulations like that in the United States. And that's a consequence of, you know, in the U.S. Constitution, there's this thing called the Commerce Clause. And it basically says the federal government controls trade between states. States can't make rules that, you know, sort of infringe on other states. So because it's controlled at the federal level, you get a much more centralized, uniform set of rules. And that makes it so much easier for businesses to operate. So I think it makes a lot more sense for Canadian provinces to, ease their own regulation and allow for a more unified federal framework.
I'm just thinking here, we've talked about the base case, and actually the base case sounds all right to me. Like, we're on the cusp of coming out of this. I know, I feel like Vancouver real estate probably feels like we've definitely been in a recession, at least in the real estate business. And it's been deeper and longer than probably the rest of Canada's felt. But yeah, that's good news. Can we talk about some of the other potential directions we go? Maybe like, you know, a more negative picture, and then maybe a more positive picture, and how you guys grade, or how Moody's grades the potential for different outcomes?
Yeah, as I said at the top, you know, we do a lot of alternative macroeconomic scenario forecasting. That comes in a lot of different forms. You know, some of the scenarios we produce, we assign probabilities to those. Some scenarios we produce are just, you know, like a what if this happens. You know, it's just sort of too hard to assign like a probability to it. So particularly, if we think about risks at the moment, you know, again, it goes back to, you know, the U.S.-Iran conflict. The what if downside scenario, you have to start to imagine, you know, what if we just get a prolonged closure for the Strait of Hormuz and no oil moves through that? We can sort of do some like quick back of the envelope calculations. Think about it this way. About 20% of the world's oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz. If that stops, if that gets completely shut down, you have to ask yourself the question, well, how much would prices have to increase so that, you know, the quantity of oil people want to buy goes down by 20%?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that oil prices or oil demand, oil consumption is not very sensitive to prices. You know, how high would gas prices have to go before you change your driving and or cancel, you know, a planned road trip or vacation? You really got to jack up oil prices to get people to start cutting back. And that's what we call it, elasticities in economics, these sort of like sensitivities. And if you look at sort of what the literature and research says, the increase in price would have to be about 5 times the change in quantity.
Wow.
Which means if you lose 20% of the world's oil, the price of oil would probably have to increase by 100% in order to get you sort of back to an equilibrium. Which means, you know, we were starting at, let's say, US 60 before the conflict started. So, you know, the new equilibrium would be somewhere around, you know, like 120 US a barrel. That generates a significant inflation shock. And how does the central bank react in that case? I don't think the Bank of Canada hikes rates. So we put together like a downside scenario where we have, you know, the conflict lasting longer, oil prices go higher. I think even in that scenario, I don't think the Bank of Canada raises interest rates and they sort of allow temporary increase in inflation because the labor market is, you know, sort of relatively weak at the moment, because the economy is relatively fragile because of tariffs and, you know, the other things going on. In that scenario, yeah, we get a mild recession. So nothing like COVID or global financial crisis or anything on that scale, but it's kind of dot-com bubble bursting kind of mild recession. So that's our most likely downside scenario. Part of that scenario also usually involves, you know, sort of a steep drop in equity prices. Seems like, you know, equity prices are quite elevated at the moment relative to fundamentals. So there is a increased risk of a stock market correction at the moment. And I think that's why, you know, you saw when the conflict kicked up, you saw that, you know, sort of rapid pullback in equity prices, because valuations are pretty lofty right now. And there's a lot of downside risks in stock prices. So that's sort of rounds out the pessimistic scenario. On the upside, I'd say sort of I think anytime we sort of think about upside scenarios, you know, part of it would clearly involve a rapid de-escalation of geopolitical risk. But really, probably the biggest potential upside driver right now is productivity gains from artificial intelligence and the investment and the return on that. And we are starting to see that in some of the data. It's very preliminary, but we were working on some AI scenarios. And there are, of course, darker AI scenarios, but I personally tend to be more of a sort of tech optimist when it comes to these things. And we have scenarios that reflect that. But I think that's sort of the easiest way you get to an upside scenario. Geopolitical risks come down and you get something that helps boost productivity growth. Particularly in Canada, where productivity growth has been a significant issue for many years, you know, over a decade,
and right,
been a big part of the conversation. Optimistic that, you know, artificial intelligence and these new kind of investments could help sort of rekindle productivity growth in Canada.
It would be interesting to talk a little bit more about AI. But before we get to that, you know, you mentioned that you don't think Canada, the Bank of Canada, raises rates this year. One thing that we've been noticing, and this is like literally on the ground, is that the five-year fixed rates and the three-year fixed rates have increased over the last couple months. There's been some bond volatility, I guess.
Yeah.
How does this all link to real estate? Just to like get
that's a real estate podcast, right?
This is a real estate podcast. So if rates the base case strikes me as like a good news story, fairly boring, kind of charts with what local economists are talking about with in the real estate market, that sales volume should increase gradually over 2026. We should churn through some of our inventory and kind of get back to a healthier market. But what's your take on the Canadian real estate environment?
Yeah, going back to what you said about rates, I think the changes you're seeing largely reflect that investors had penciled in a couple US Fed cuts for 2026, thinking, you know, okay, inflation's cooling down in the United States. It's been more elevated than it has been in Canada because of, you know, the tariffs. Inflation in Canada, it's going to go up, but it did get under 2% briefly. It's been more elevated in the United States. So the expectation was we're going to get, you know, 2-3 rate cuts in 2026. Those are coming off the table because of what's happening with energy prices and inflation. So investors, you know, it's not just domestic interest rates in Canada that can affect Canadian mortgage rate. Kind of depends on the overall, you know, global credit conditions. How tight are global credit markets? Because Canadian banks don't, you know, they don't just raise capital in Canada. They raise capital from all over the world.
Right.
And the United States, you think, is sort of that global benchmark. So financial conditions tighter than expected. So banks are sort of changing their forecast for 2026. And that's why you saw those rates perk back up. Going forward, though, you know, I said I don't expect the Bank of Canada to raise rates, but they're certainly not going to cut rates in this environment. So the trouble is, you know, if you're in the real estate market, you shouldn't anticipate any interest rate relief coming down the road. And frankly, you know, where interest rates, mortgage rates are right now, we think it's sort of pretty close to their long-run average, their long-run equilibrium. So people expecting, you know, we're going to go back to the glory days of I can get a mortgage for like 2%. I don't see that realistically, you know, unless there's some horrible recession where the Bank of Canada just starts slashing rates. I mean, that's the only way we get back to like a 2% mortgage again. That's that part. And so then the other part you ask yourself is, you know, the other big driver of housing is going to be the labor market. There, one piece of caution, you know, I've been putting out recently is that because of the changes in immigration policy, that is causing the Canadian labor force to shrink, which is sort of skewing some of the labor market statistics. In particular, it actually ends up making unemployment look lower than it actually is. So I think some of the recent, you know, even though unemployment's been pretty flat recently, I think that probably, you know, overstates the health of the labor market. That being said, I went back to the baseline forecast I talked about before, that while Canada is stuck in this soft patch, we expect growth to start to accelerate at the end of the year. That means hiring comes back. That means income growth, wage growth starts to pick up. And that will help, you know, kickstart or you know, inject some fresh life back into the housing market. Because, you know, certainly it's been a, you know, rough stretch for housing in Canada the last few years. Even, you know, even with all, you know, the ups and then, you know, like the downs in house prices, you know, one of the things I've really been struck by is how strong new construction has actually remained. So, you know, you think about some of like the price drops, you think about, you know, oh, is this, you know, spooking builders? Or are they going to, you know, pull back on, you know, the number of new intentions, permitting, number of new homes they're building? Not really. I was looking at the, you know, Vancouver stats this morning, you know, number of units under construction, still near all-time record high. Pace of new housing starts slowed down a little, but it's still pretty brisk. You know, permitting is new strong, pretty strong. So I think the thing, maybe the sort of the final point I make here is when you do hear people complain about affordability in the housing market, which is a definite issue, that also means, you know, a person who's complaining about affordability is a person who wants to buy a house, right? So like the demand is out there if you can sort of get that affordability a little, you know, back into a better place. So yeah, if you look at our house price forecast for Canada, we have house prices going to come down a little bit more as we get through 2026. But income growth keeps going. Interest rates, you know, mostly stay flat. That improves affordability. That's going to bring some new demand back into the market.
So we're down roughly, I mean, the stats will tell you approximately 7% or so in this market, but I think it's probably more like just rounded out at around 10% plus or minus a few points on either side, depending on the sub-market. In your mind then, is Vancouver a buy right now for people? Like, do you see, are you anticipating that kind of this time next year we'll be in a better position then? Just to kind of, you know, flesh out the comments that you're making.
Given Vancouver is the most expensive real estate market in Canada, it's hard to like really deem it like a buy, because I don't know, then does every other, you know, market in Canada have to be a buy too? Certainly, you know, I think there are amenities, quality of life. You know, I visited Vancouver a couple of times, like love the city. I understand why people are willing to, you know, pay a premium to live there. I don't know if I can characterize it as a buy opportunity. Considering if you look at the shape of our scenarios, for the Vancouver market, there's a small upside and a big downside, I would say. Ask yourself, you know, realistically, even in an optimistic scenario, in your most optimistic scenario for the Vancouver real estate market, what type of appreciation would you think you could get over like the next few years? Versus paint a dark scenario, how big could those price declines be? So if you think about sort of those scenarios around the baseline forecast, there's a lot of downside skew in the Vancouver market because of that affordability problem, because elevation, you know, valuations are so high.
Well, to that point, a common conversation right now about Vancouver real estate is that we're kind of moving more to a typical Canadian city where we might do kind of, you know, 2-4% per year, kind of click along potentially. But the big runs of, you know, 20% annually are basically gone for the foreseeable future. And do you think that's an accurate portrayal?
I think it would probably be good for the Vancouver real estate market to catch its breath a little bit. You know, it wasn't just the big price run up in, you know, 2021. You know, we also had a big run up in prices around, you know, 2016, 2017. So,
right.
You know, we really had back-to-back booms in the Vancouver real estate market. So I guess to my, you know, upside downside scenario, you know, can you really expect a third boom in a row now? That just seems, you know, unrealistic. So likely to be the case that if you're judging the real estate market purely in terms of like annual appreciation, I think you'd expect Vancouver to be a laggard versus, you know, the national average in some other areas, where areas that are more affordable are going to see, you know, more in-migration. And I think that sort of, you know, sort of is one of the fundamental problems for Vancouver is, you know, like the worse that affordability gets, it starts acting against, you know, migration. You know, fewer and fewer people are going to decide to, you know, I can realistically, you know, afford to move and live in the city.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to go back to the comments about efficiency and AI and being a tech optimist. I feel like I hear a lot about, you know, the K-shaped economy, and presumably AI doesn't do anything to help lessen kind of the divide between the haves and the have-nots, really. How is Moody's kind of thinking about AI that way in terms of their forecasting, in terms of potential job loss, in terms of maybe the GDP numbers looking great, but on the ground being kind of less of an economy that's working for everyone?
Yeah, I think there are, if you make some different assumptions, you can definitely get at some different sort of end scenarios for artificial intelligence. So specifically the one you're talking about, this sort of K-shaped forecast, where for viewers that aren't familiar, that would be, you know, all the benefit goes to the high income folks, low income folks, you know, lose their jobs. So it's a sort of two-part recovery. It's a different recovery, you know, or rich folks do well, poor folks, bottom line. I think the big question there is, who captures the profits from AI? Which is to say, you know, all these big companies right now, you know, Anthropic, you know, whatever, are they going to, you know, if you think about like all these, they're building all these new AI models, you know, these companies are in, you know, this rat race with each other, you know, constantly trying to outdo each other with better and better models. On some level, these AI models are becoming sort of tools. They're becoming commodified, which is, you know, you think about there's sort of eventually there could be, you know, sort of so many free sort of AI models, AI agents out there that the companies producing these have struggled to charge money for them. So the perfect example I'll use is if we go back to the dot-com boom and the IT revolution, there was a company called Global Crossing. And you know what they did was they laid the undersea cables that it was the backbone, the infrastructure of the entire internet. And everyone was thinking, you know, oh, Global Crossing, you know, this is the company that controls they're building the infrastructure of the internet. This is going to be like the most valuable company on like the face of the earth. Turns out, no. I think they eventually went out of business or bankrupt or something. And the reason is that eventually, like so many companies got in the game, laid so much cable that there's just a glut of bandwidth capacity, undersea, you know, internet cable. So they couldn't charge people, you know, much money to use it. So in the same sense, if AI companies are going to capture the profits of AI, you know, a K-shape, so all the profits go to, you know, the AI overlords and, you know, everyone else is like left with nothing. That scenario depends on sort of the AI companies being able to protect their intellectual property. And so kind of what I'm arguing in some sense is, look, couldn't someone come along and sort of, you know, rip them off, copy their product, or make sort of like a cheap imitation of their product that works almost as well for like 90% of people? And so there's all this sort of undercutting that can go on. In that case, who sort of, you know, to the extent that AI, you know, makes us more productive, more efficient, the profits from that would accrue to, you know, the companies that are using AI to build tools. So to use another example again, going back to like the dot-com boom in the internet, who are the most profitable companies to emerge from sort of that dot-com boom, it's Facebook, you know, Google, Microsoft, sort of others. They didn't make the internet. They just made products that, you know, sort of service the internet or sort of help you use the internet. So you can see, or you know, maybe like social media, like Facebook is a very good example where, you know, this company didn't invent the internet, but they created a product that, you know, relies, uses the internet. And they're the ones who are able to generate profit from that, you know, less so than, you know, the people that, you know, own the K cables and the switchboards and, you know, sort of the infrastructure of the internet. I think there was a second part to your question. I've completely forgotten that at this point.
No. That makes sense. That makes sense that it's those who will be able to use the tools.
That's my key question. Yeah. So to summarize things, the question is, who's going to profit from AI? Is it the companies building the AI, you know, the AI tools right now? Or is it going to be companies that are going to take those tools and build something else with it?
Right.
And I think that's more sort of spreads out the profits and the wealth.
I feel like that's a really useful framing of it. One kind of follow-up question to that, though, is, you know, thinking of the average Canadian making 80 grand a year or whatever, if those companies can use those tools to have 100 employees as opposed to 1,000 employees, right? Is Moody's thinking about that? And that's kind of yet to be seen, but presumably over time, fewer and fewer people are needed to run these companies.
That's an interesting question. Because then this raises the point, does AI complement labor or is it a substitute for labor? I mean, you're making the argument that, you know, where there's a risk here, AI is going to substitute, it's going to replace labor. But on the other hand, you know, employees can use these tools to make themselves more productive. So one, I was talking to another colleague and sort of one interesting example he pointed out was, you know, in the pizza industry, we already have sort of full automation. There are robots out there. You can press a button and they'll, you know, cook a pizza for you. Is that what we see, though, in practice? You go around to, you know, different restaurants and things like that. You know, to what extent have they actually, you know, automated their pizza ovens and, you know, other things of other sorts? So I think even though the technical ability might exist, it's not a foregone conclusion that, you know, it's just going to sort of completely replace those workers. And, you know, how much adoption or, you know, how deep is the adoption? Because, you know, on the other hand, automation costs, you know, money. If you're not using, it's not like you get rid of the worker and you just get to like keep the money. You would have to replace that worker with a machine running on some software. There's going to be, you know, maintenance costs associated with that. So there's costs on the other side of things. And then, you know, what if, you know, new technology comes along and you want to update your machine? You know, sort of how complicated is that? So it's not exactly clear that AI is going to be a substitute for labor. On the other hand, the other point I always like to make is I think it's a lot easier to imagine which jobs might go away versus, you know, which jobs are going to get created. You know, the story I always use is my father worked for a Canadian printing and publishing company. So you can imagine dot-com boom comes along, demand for, you know, printed materials, books, magazines, newspapers, all that sort of stuff, you know, collapses. And sad as it was, you know, my father ended up losing his job. But would the alternative be better where, you know, we never got computers and the internet and we're all still reading books, magazines, and newspapers? So, you know, as much as it was like, you know, hard for my family, I don't think I could say, you know, oh, we have to stop progress and, you know, we can't advance technology anymore because some people are going to lose their jobs because we came out with the new technology. So certainly the government, you know, needs a mindset of, for those people who lose their jobs, how can we reskill them? You know, how can we give them new skills to compete in the global labor market? You have to think about reskilling for those people who do lose their jobs. But on the other hand, you know, I would say go back 20 years ago, get in a time machine, go back 20 years ago, you know, ask most people, what's a podcaster? I don't know. You know, that job didn't even exist 20 years ago. So that's my point is I think AI is going to create new jobs. And since we're not there yet, it's just sort of hard to imagine what those jobs are even going to be.
Fair enough. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Brendan. But I was going to say, does that make Vancouver real estate a buy? Was the final. We do have this segment that you may remember called the Five Wire Five.
Oh, right.
Lighthearted questions to finish the show. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Absolutely.
One book you've read recently, on the page turner, whether it was actually a hard copy or not, that you'd recommend?
Actually, speaking of AI, it was a little, I mean, not a respect, but with the whole kickoff of AI, I actually got into, I wanted to sort of go back in time and read some like sci-fi novels from like the 1940s, 50s, where, you know, rocketry and space exploration is like just getting off the ground. Because it's very interesting to see, you know, how they sort of speculate about sort of like what the future of space is going to look like. And it's sort of very much like we're speculating right now. So the book I'm going to recommend is called Rendezvous with Rama. Basically, it's a very interesting mystery. Basically, the people on Earth, they start to see a spacecraft coming towards them. It's not making any communication. It's just heading towards Earth. And they're going to send a crew, go see, you know, what's going on. But yeah, I think particularly because you sort of get that going back in time, looking forward, I think it's sort of very fascinating. Sort of, what did people in the past sort of speculate about what the future was going to look like?
Right. And yeah, how that's a right great or one. Wrong they got it. That's
exactly. So because it's like your shocks about like, oh my God, they like perfectly predicted this. And then other things you're like, oh, that was a product of the times.
Question number two, in the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Belief, behavior, or habit? The golf driving range. So I'm not sure if either of you are like golfers, but I was a big golfer when I was a kid. Then with, you know, job, kids. But now I'm looking for more reasons to get out of the house. So, you know, one thing I've really found is nice is there's a driving range 5-10 minutes down the road from me. And just, you know, on my lunch break, drive over, grab a bucket of balls and just, you know, just crank away. It's sort of like a little meditation. Like it's quiet. You're not like talking to anybody. You just sort of like sit there and it gives you like a distraction. You're outside. That's always a good thing too. So if anyone's looking for a little mental health break, I'd recommend go down to the driving range, hit a few balls.
That's a great one.
That is a great one. What have you been binge watching lately? Your favorite movie? Recent favorite movie, I guess.
Favorite movie. I don't know. It's all just like Netflix crud. I don't know. What was the last one? Night Agent. But I don't even know if I would like recommend it. I don't know. It's like a spy. You know, it's like one of those like spy thrillers. I love those spy thriller kind of shows. My bottom line, any show with like undercover agent, secret spy, you know, going behind enemy lines. That's always a winner for me. So the Night Agent, I think, is like one of those shows on Netflix right now. You know, any of like the Jack Ryan, you know, movies or anything like that. I'm always a sucker for those.
It is true, though, what you say. I had this thought last night. The golden age of television is over, I think. It seems like even the stuff that's celebrated right now is not great. You guys might disagree with me, but I was sitting on the couch last night and I literally went back and started watching The Sopranos again from episode one. Like, this is just better TV. It's better TV than anything out there. More interesting. Anyway, food for thought. Discuss. That's... No, just jokes. moving on.
All right. Question number four, Brendan. Favorite band or music?
I've been looking for something new. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm sort of listening to like the same songs like over and over again. Recently, I picked up a little sort of like side job, sort of teaching at a local university. Just because I work remote, it kind of felt like, you know, nice to, you know, get out of the house, interact with some like young kids. I don't know why, but I started listening to like the country music station as I drive to work now. I am not a country music fan. I've never been. I grew up in, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, you know, like the heart of like Yankee America. There was no country music station in Boston when I was growing up. But I don't know what it is. It's like the weather's getting warm now. You know, I want to like put down my window, kind of got like a happy. I don't even know any of the names of the songs. It's pretty frank.
I feel like you're preaching to the choir
radio.
Here.
It's my recommendation. Just throw on country music radio. It's sort of a change of pace.
Right on. Yeah. And last but not least, something you have purchased for under $1,500 that has had a positive impact on your life in the last couple of years.
You may be asking this question before, and I'm not sure what answer I gave. I do have one recommendation. I think it was a year or two ago, I bought a 4K HD projector, and I built like a sort of quasi cinema room in my basement. So I have like a 100-inch projector screen. And it's got like a little button, you know, up there so you can lower it up and down. And then you get like the four, you have to put it in the basement because it has to be like completely dark in the room where it doesn't like work well. But I that was a few years ago. I bet it would be just about $1,500 US. So we're pushing the limit of the budget here. Yeah, but these HD projectors are like really cool. We had like some neighbors over the other day and you could like bring it outside and like shoot it at the side of your house to like put up, you know, like the basketball or football game or like whatever people want to watch. So I can't believe how much I actually love this thing and how much use I actually get out of it. So if you're a bit of a home theater junkie, if you like that kind of stuff, get a projector.
I've got a neighbor who's been, encouraging me to get one of those for like 3 years now. And I think it's around, like 2,700 bucks Canadian or something, but he waxes poetic about it. No, yeah, he absolutely loves it though. So no, that's the sec. I might have to do it at some point here, but that's great.
So Brendan, we know the website, but how can people that are interested in finding out more about what you guys are putting out in regards to Canada, but also the world, find out more about what's going on over at Moody's and what you specifically are up to?
Yeah, it's real easy. You can go to economy.com. That was actually our original name. So it's real easy. Economy.com. That'll bring you to us. Moody's.com will also work, of course. You know, check out our social media and whatnot. We're always posting articles and putting out different reports.
That was great. Well, hey, yeah, thanks again, Brendan. That was tons of takeaways from that conversation. And we look forward to having you back in the future and seeing how all of this unfolds.
All right. Well, what's 1 year from today? we'll check back in.
Awesome. Thanks again.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Brendan Lacerda over at Moody's Analytics, Director of Economic Research North America, with that Canadian specialty. It's great. Always having Brendan on. I feel like we have him on annually, and it's a really nice check-in to get that outsider's perspective on what is going right and what is going wrong in Canada.
Always enjoy having Brendan on the show. Yeah, I think that is the key to those episodes that I love is just hearing him talking about Canadian economy, Canadian real estate, and of course, Vancouver. He loves Vancouver, by the way. That comes through every time you talk to him. I feel like he spends a lot of time, any opportunity he can here. And must be interesting to study something kind of where you don't live and then visit it and see it. And it's just...
I know, it's like he's an anthropologist.
He feels... I know. He's totally.
The other thing that I've been thinking a lot about is hitting the driving range at lunch.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a good idea. But yeah, maybe we'll save that for next episode.
Yeah.
Adam, one thing I did want to point out is we've worked with hundreds of people who listen to this show over the years, and they're some of the best clients we've had, that is for sure. If you're looking to buy and sell, of course, or sell, or just want to get in touch, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. We have buyer's resources, seller's resources over there. Or you can just give me a call or text at 778-847-2854 or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that nonpartisan line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, everyone. We're back here next week with another great episode. I'm so excited about the roster we got coming this year. This is incredible. And sent some invites out today. Fired up about some potential guests joining us as well. So stay tuned. Another great episode next week.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.